This is Professor Allen, and welcome to the Quarter Bin. In every episode of this podcast, I will summarize, criticize, discuss, and review a single issue from my comic book collection, which I will select at random. Any book from my entire collection is eligible, as long as I paid no more than 25 cents for it. Was the issue worth 25 cents? Was it a bargain at 25 cents? Or was it still overpriced? Stay tuned and find out. For this 144th episode of the Quarter Bin, we are looking at the highest issue number in the entire history of the podcast, by far, by looking at Four Color Comics 1253, a.k.a. Spaceman number 1, from Dell Comics, cover dated January through March 1962. This is also the oldest book we've covered on the show in almost 4 years. And for only the second time, we're covering a book that is older than me. That other book was Black Hawk 122 from 1958, which we covered all the way back on episode 62. But first, and even before we get to feedback, we need to talk. We need to have a conversation about the shocking and disappointing disappearance of that most elusive of species, the Central Ohio Quarterbin. It was probably 10 years ago now when I first saw the sign outside the comic store in Lancaster, Ohio. Quarterly 25-cent comic book sale. Now, it had been a long time since I'd been in a comic store at that point, but I had gotten back into comics via podcasts and trades at the public library. But I wandered into that store, and I found dozens and dozens of long boxes of quarter books. And in those boxes, I found many of the super books that Dragon Con's Michael Bailey would be soon covering on the excellent podcast From Crisis to Crisis. And that's how my quarter book collection started. And then it went to reconstituting collections of titles that I sold when we moved out here to Ohio, like Warlord and Rom, John Sable Freelance. And then as the years went by, I found more and more books that looked cool. And the Quarter Bin database was born. And there wasn't even a podcast yet. But I was preparing for something nonetheless. Now, about 3 or 4 years ago, I'd say that store in the ballpark closed down, and the quarterly Quarter Bin sales bit the dust as well. But that was okay with me, because by then I discovered that the Half Price Books location in my area had quarter books. That's what their unlabeled, unpriced books were going for. That was the default. But a couple of years ago, I went into one day, one of the locations, and saw that unmarked books were suddenly $2? Talk about inflation. Now, since then, they've dropped that price to $1, but that is the minimum nowadays. They don't have anything cheaper than that. But that, too, was okay with me, because by then, Em and I had decided, after almost a year of trying out the many pretty good comic book stores in this area, to make World's Greatest Comics, our LCS, in terms of where our pull list would be. And that was for two reasons. One, a great customer service mentality, genuinely nice and welcoming employees. And two, quarter bins. Earlier in this year, in preparation for a move to a larger space in the same shopping mall, those quarter bins disappeared. There have been a number of delays for the move, issues with the shopping center, and those quarter bins have not come back. And chatting with the owner, a truly nice and good store owner, it's not clear that they're gonna come back based on how he plans to lay out the new store. There are more profitable ways to utilize your retail square footage than having a handful of boxes with merchandise priced that low. Now, in the old configuration, those quarter bins were on the floor under tables that had dollar bins on top of them. And he has commented more than once that in the new location, they're not going to have anything on floors. So I won't know for sure until after that move finally does occur a few weeks after this episode is expected to be released. But let's just say I've got a bad feeling about this. This is Professor Allen from the future interrupting the episode. This episode has been delayed a little bit, and so the new location of World's Greatest Comics has opened up, and there are no quarter bins there. You can ask Little Russell Burbage, or Al Girding, or the irredeemable Shag. We all stopped by the new store a few days after it opened, and like I said, nary a quarter bin in sight. So as far as I know, I'm not counting on having a regular inflow of quarter bin books into the database. The occasional sale, the occasional 50-cent book with two reprinted issues, like last episode. The cheap boxes at a con, maybe. But nothing reliable or predictable. Now, the podcast database has plenty of books in it. So that's not an issue, at least not for the foreseeable future. But this situation of not having new books to add to the cheap bins, that has got me thinking. Now, the point of this show, in the big picture, is to talk about cheap books that are available out there that theoretically anyone could stumble across in the wild. Unless you live in New England, where the cheapest thing you can find is a buck. I understand that, but that's sort of the mandate for the podcast. And that's why comics that people send me as gifts, as part of the hashtag comic book circle of life, that's why I don't include them in the quarter bin show. Because someone giving me a book doesn't mean it really is a cheap comic that anyone could find, right? That's not what I think of as the spirit or intention of the podcast. But that's also one reason why I started the Comics Reading Journal, to have a place to talk about all of those books. Because they really just don't qualify over here. I know what you're thinking, but they cost you nothing, Professor. Technically, that's true. But that doesn't necessarily make them cheap comics, if you know what I mean. But as I thought about it, maybe other types of books could qualify for quarter bin treatment. Because in the 6+ years that we've been doing the show, the nature of comics distribution has changed. And the legal availability of legally inexpensive digital comics has legally exploded. I mean, legally speaking. To say nothing of physical trades that are readily available in most public libraries across the U.S. for free. And all of that has me thinking about expanding the database for the podcast. All of these ideas would require a minor change in the premise of the podcast, and that is that these books are, quote, in my collection. Because with digital books or borrowed books, that criteria wouldn't necessarily be met. But I don't think that would be a major change in the show's premise. So for me, trades in public libraries, digital trades available for free on the Hoopla digital app, and even books in the Digital Comics Museum. To me, those all could count as quarter bin books, in the sense that they are inexpensive in all of those cases, free comics, that are available to many, many people. And to me, I have no trouble considering that within the original spirit of the Quarter Bin podcast, exploring comics that are readily available for cheap. I don't think including those would be that much of a stretch. Now, a tougher argument to make, and if it did expand, I'd probably draw the line before here, but I think it's actually worth considering, and that is concepts like the DC Universe app or Marvel Unlimited, etc. Now, for those, there is a monthly fee involved. But how do you allocate that to a specific individual comic? Especially when those apps have TV shows, movies, cartoons, etc. How do you count that? And from an economics perspective, there's no marginal cost. Once that fixed monthly charge has been committed to, the cost of additional comic to read is zero. So you could say that every book on the DC Universe or Marvel app could count. But I think that is way too stretching of the definition of free or cheap, stretching it way too far for my comfort. So like I said, I would never include those. I would not include those books, the books from those digital services, in the quarter bin database, even though I've heard the irredeemable Shag talk about the number of books that he's read on Marvel Unlimited and the amount of money that he's paid for it and how it does work out for him to be less than a quarter. But still, I think that's a different kettle of fish. But I am strongly considering including those other sources, making those eligible for coverage here on the show. Again, that's physical trades from public libraries, digital trades from the free Hoopla digital app, and the free public domain digital comics museum. Now, I'm curious what you guys think. I know most of you are laid back and have a, it's your show, Professor, you make the rules approach, and I appreciate that. I don't want to give the appearance that this is a democracy, not even a constitutional monarch, because this podcast is organized along the lines of the great and victorious monarchy of Latveria, led by a kind and benevolent ruler of all. It's just that I don't want to change the show radically in terms of its mandate, or as I keep referring to, the spirit of the Quarterbin podcast. I want that to remain. So if you have strong feelings about this potential minor change to the show's branding, the show's concept, let me know on Twitter or Messenger or email, whatever of those feedback methods works for you. Because it's kind of like when one of my favorite podcasts, Back to the Bins, on the Two True Freaks Network, when they cover a recent book. Now, usually, that still makes for a really good episode of a really good show, and I still enjoy it. It's a fun change of pace. But it's also not really their thing. It's not really what they normally do. And it's not what I want them to do all the time. So I don't want to change things up and throw off the listening experience too much. But there's something about acknowledging that there are additional legitimate sources for free books that have come about since this show started that I thought was worth paying attention to. Especially if literal physical quarter bins, it may be a bit harder for me to find going forward. Okay, that was a lot of me just going blah, blah, blah. So let's change things up a bit and listen to you guys blah, blah, blah a bit by going over a little feedback. And a debate broke out on Twitter after a certain listener,
the irredeemable Shag,
expressed his unreasonable and unfounded, silly, and emotional responses to the budgetary cost situation in that Ghost Rider issue from a few episodes back. And the 2019 Deceit in Podcasting Award goes to the failing Quarterbin podcast for episode 142, in which at Professor Allen, at of relatively underscore geek, paid 50 cents for the comic in question. Shame, Professor, shame? Apparently upholding standards isn't important for some people. To which Stella from Batgirl to Oracle replied, spilling bile that had been building up in her for years, "Finally, someone else is noticing the lies." Well, actually, Stella. Now, Dr. And repeated a scurrilous accusation he made last episode when we talked about this subject, which I thought we had completely finished talking about. Hope his students don't find out about this. Fortunately, one lovely listener, Robert Ludwig, the most sane man among us, came to my defense with an incredibly logical and well-thought-out comment. If somebody gives him a quarter, then the good professor will still be within the mandate of the podcast. Thank you, Robert. Thank you. Thank you. Now, on this topic, Luke Giaconetti, from a range of shows on the Tutu Freaks Internet Radio Network, explained the situation to Shag, using the acronym GAAP, G-A-A-P, to describe the accounting rules, generally accepted accounting principles. GAAP says that Alan is perfectly fine in counting the compiled release as its component parts for the purpose of reporting, look it up, hashtag fact. Shag then replied with this bunch of mumbo-jumbo. But precedent demands he's never done this manipulating of issue page count on previous episodes, hashtag gerrymandering. Which is why people love Luke and despise Shag, hashtag fact. Mark Baker Wright also brought up an interesting point, which is somewhat what I addressed in the first portion of this episode. Not having been able to find stores actually selling comics for less than a dollar for quite some time now, I'm surprised the professor has held out for this long, which I take as both a compliment and a complete full-throated endorsement, hashtag fact. And Derek William Crabb of the terrific Fanholes podcast and the excellent YouTube series, The History of Comics on Film, brought his keen insights and unparalleled intellect to this discussion, coming down firmly on my side. Hashtag fact. Now, our knight from across the pond, Sir Martin of Grey, of the excellent blog, Too Dangerous for a Girl, commented on Ghost Rider as well, but he focused reasonably on the actual issue, talking about the new creative team that took over. It was a massive improvement. The previous issues weren't awful, enjoyably mediocre, at a time when comics were so cheap that mediocre was fine. Didn't you just love those days? But suddenly, Martin continues, there was a real burst of energy. It felt that we were going somewhere. It's a shame that these reprints don't use the new logo, because the old one is just Dullsville. Looking back on that cover, yeah, it is a little plain. And Luke Giaconetti also commenting on the content of the Ghost Rider issue. Sorry, issues. It was two issues. That's my story and I'm sticking with it. Hashtag fact. Professor, wanted to drop you a quick note to say I enjoyed your coverage of the original Ghost Rider rides again. I'm always on the lookout for oddball reprints like these because, like you, I've been known to buy oversized comics out of the cheapy bins simply for the ROI when it comes to cost per page. That would be return on investment. Very good, Luke. Especially for silver or Bronze Age comics like this. Exactly. I don't know what is so hard for people like, I don't know, Shag, for example, just hypothetically, to understand about this. Luke says that when this issue was published in 1991, the second Ghost Rider, Danny Ketch, was about to strike it big at Marvel. Shortly down the road, Marvel would launch the Midnight Suns imprint, anchored by Ghost Rider's main title and featuring the return of Johnny Blaze in the team-up Spirits of Vengeance book. GR was so popular that after the original Ghost Rider Rides Again finished its run, Marvel transitioned to a new reprint title, simply Original Ghost Rider, which ran for 20 more issues. That series reprinted Blaze's strips from its beginnings in Marvel Spotlight through issue 12 of that series. But wait, there's more, Luke says. Personal favorite Morbius, the Living Vampire, also got a reprint series after the launch of his eponymous title in 1992, an issue of which we covered on a previous episode of the Quarterbin Professor. Entitled Morbius Revisited, the book ran for 5 issues and reprinted his early solo material from the book Fear. While it may seem strange now, the supernatural characters certainly had a large footprint at the House of Ideas in the 1990s. You keep recording them, and I'll keep listening to them, Luke. Thanks for that info, Luke. You keep feedbacking, and I'll keep reading your feedback. Now, last episode, episode 143, got a response as well from Sir Martin of Grey, who called it a terrific episode. I've not heard of gods for hire. You actually made it sound interesting, with a couple of non-obvious tweaks to the modern knight's cliché. When you then said it was pretty awful, I was a tad surprised, but you justified the probably not worth 25 cents beautifully. Well, Sir Martin and other listeners, I did not want to spoil how unimpressive the book was throughout the whole episode, so I kind of saved that for the analysis portion. I'm glad that worked for you, Martin. The framing sequence of those first couple pages sounds rubbish, taking away any suspense as to the fate of at least one character. What a contrast to the Ghost Rider confession you detailed the time before, in which the story Johnny Blaze tells the priest, quote-unquote, sets up a terrific surprise ending about the pretendy priest's true identity. Which brings us to Mr. Panarees and his comments on short stories. Uh-oh! Feedback on feedback. Watch out for cracks in space-time, people. Of all the ones he mentioned that I've read, Sir Martin says, A Perfect Day for Banana Fish is my favorite. I love all J.D. Salinger's Glass family works, and I can imagine M being a fan. I do not know the answer to that, Sir Martin. Hashtag parental fail. He also talked about having music in the episode, that no matter how loud it is or isn't, it doesn't work for him. I mostly listen to podcasts in the gym, with crappy music blaring out that I can hear even with the headphones on. But I'm okay with a talk-only podcast when a show has music behind the voice and there's gym music too. I'm certain I miss stuff. I get that, Martin, and I think the takeaway from that is, don't go to the gym. Problem solved. Seriously, Sir Martin, sorry about that. This is the only show on the network that has music under it, and I really like that fact. I like that distinction. So although the duration of music has lessened, and certainly the volume has decreased over the years, I am going to keep it. It helps the podcast, I think, stand out from the rest. And on last episode, Billy D from Monsters and Magazine said that it was a good show, as always. Thank you, sir. Last episode received social media love from Sir Iowa's Joe, Chris from Bat Books for Beginners, Drew from Comics for Fun and Profit and the office down the hall and around the corner from me on campus, Pat from the Long Box Crusade, Gene Hendricks, Randy Watts, Herman from the Long Box of Darkness, Karen from Between the Pages, and Laurel, a.k.a. Mountain Flower One, from the Hunters Podcast. That was a lot of me yammering. So let's take a break here, and when we come back, we're just going to talk about our issue for this episode.
In 1975, Jaws was released. It is routinely regarded as one of the greatest films of all time and is generally credited with creating the concept of the summer blockbuster. In 1978, in an obvious cash grab, Jaws 2 was released, failing to have lightning strike a second time, but presenting a generally enjoyable film. In 1983, Jaws 3D was released, shamelessly attempting to take advantage of a gullible audience. By 1987, there was no pretense of quality as Lorraine Gary and Michael Caine cashed paychecks for sleepwalking through a pointless and incredulous sequel. In 2016, Paul Spitero created Is It Jaws, in which he and a group of rotating guest hosts discuss new and old movies and place them up against the Jaws scale, which ignores some elements of the actual films and sets forth a rating scale. Jaws, an all-time great classic film. Jaws 2, an enjoyable film with some flaws but worthy of multiple viewings. Jaws 3, a moderately enjoyable film And finally, Jaws 4, a bad movie. Please join Paul and his guests as they ask the ever-important question, is it Jaws?
Four Color Comics 1253, a.k.a. Spaceman Number 1, had a cover price of 15 cents, meaning I acquired this book at a 67% markup over the original retail price. What a ripoff! The cover, by unknown, shows a pair of astronauts, one on the moon, one floating down to land on the lunar surface. Both are in traditional-looking white-gray spacesuits. A pair of rockets are nearby, and Earth hangs in the sky in the background. Text in a very subdued font tells us man has broken the ties of Earth and is about to conquer space. Now, my copy of this is missing a chunk from the top right, an irregular area of about 2 inches by 3 inches. But I'm not missing anything important other than part of the Spaceman logo. It's a good cover. The all-black background, signifying space, is something you don't see that often. It is appropriately stark for the setting and for the type of story. Now, maybe it's just a usage of the word that I'm not used to, having been born after this comic came out, but I have to say that the title Spaceman just seems kind of odd. To me, the phrase usually implies an alien, not the human going into space as the spaceman, but that word is used as a synonym for astronaut within the book. But again, to me, those are two different things, astronaut and spaceman. This was written in 1962, so I'm not sure if that was common usage. But again, to me, a spaceman is someone visiting Earth, not someone leaving Earth. That may just be me. Or like I said, it might be the 57 or 58 years that have passed since this issue was produced. But I don't want to get hung up on that, because overall, this is a pretty good cover. That is the key takeaway. The story, which might be called Spaceman, or might be called The Secret of the Moon, was scripted by Ken Fitch with art by Jack Sparling. This might actually have no title at all. It's kind of hard to tell. But we start with a little bit of history of this Earth's version of the history of space travel, which focuses on the anti-force, a belt in space that which for 10 years or so has stopped all attempts for us to reach the moon. But now, we're trying it again as the countdown for this current launch hits zero. Our two astronauts inside the rocket are veteran Ian Lansing and space rookie Johnny Mack, who entered the program after his father disappeared into the anti-force. Ian has been halfway to the moon before, but that's as far as he got before being pushed back by this force called the anti-force. The astronauts reminisce about the training process, and we learn that Johnny's dad was the first to fly beyond Earth's gravity, but something went wrong. It cost him his life, Ian says, but he died, showing us how to make this rocket the safest craft known. Ian keeps talking, knowing the risk of the monotony of spaceflight. He reveals that he was assigned to take Johnny's father's place in the program. And he mentions Colonel Hooper, who was a great trainer and was selected to be the first to make the moon probe. He was never heard from again, Ian says of Colonel Hooper. He didn't radio the base. Maybe he tried too long to fight the anti-force. It's just one of the mysteries of space, Johnny. Hours pass and the astronauts keep their eyes on the viewer. They've done it. The physicists back home must have found the answer. Because they've passed the anti-force band. They land on the lunar surface and report in. Project Moon Probe to U.S. Earth Station. All's well. Set down on moon surface. Over. After inflating their suits, the pair land on the moon and use the lower gravity to their advantage, moving around the surface quickly. And then they see, off in the distance, some mountains and also some shapes, some beings. No, those are humanoid? They look as if they're waving, but I'm plenty scared. These almost human-looking beings surround our pair and lead them towards the mountains, and they enter a dark tunnel, the only light being the Moon Men's built-in electric chest lights. After an hour of walking through tunnels, they arrive in an airlock. I'm sure they're humans of some kind, Johnny. And then a door slides open, and astronaut Ian sees a familiar face. Colonel Hooper, sir! Everyone thought you'd been lost! Hooper reveals that the beings with them are cyborgs. As they dine on vegetables, vegetables raised on Venus? The cyborgs are Americans who have had various parts upgraded to mechanical and electronic replacement parts so they can work in the moon's climate. They'll likely spend the rest of their lives here in space. They're real heroes, believe me. We then learn that the mysterious mystical anti-force was actually created right there on the moon. They just let Ian and Johnny through instead of forcing other astronauts away, which they have done every other time in the past. Now, this is all hush-hush, top-secret stuff that started 15 years ago when Colonel Hooper was training for his flight. While still on Earth, he was visited by a pair of strange beings in flight suits and helmets. Now these guys, they're spacemen. We are from outer space. We have come on a secret mission. They are from the Galactic Guard, a group so advanced that they fear making themselves public. And that is as far as the story gets at this point, as Hooper is notified that the Gera Axos are on the move on Jupiter. They are the solar system's main enemies, those darn aliens from Alpha Centauri. It's a little confusing if the race is called the Garrus Axos, or if that's the leader of the race of the planet. It seems like those are used interchangeably. So Hooper and the other two astronauts, they lightspeed themselves right to a space battle. And our two astronauts have a hard time believing. Doubtless you've heard of flying saucers, the colonel explains. Well, now you're flying in one. On the way, we get some information about time dilation, as well as prep for the upcoming dogfight. They join in as the combined Mars and Jupiter forces go up against the enemy. The very heavens burn with the fire of hate and fury sent by the Garrick Axos against the Galactic Guard, all happening at the speed of light. Colonel Hooper leads his Squad X against a squadron of enemies that got away from the initial battle, having determined that the Force was using positive energy in their drive. The Colonel had only one choice. Release negative energy. Full power. The enemy ship is disabled, and it crashes into a nearby asteroid. And our three leads inspect the damage. The colonel says that the Garrick Axos may have been the Titans who lived on Earth thousands of years ago. Legend says they decided the sun was poisoning them, and they took their science to another galaxy, or supposed to be the descendants of the weak ones that they left behind. The three see a survivor who must be 12 feet tall, and Ian wonders if they should take him prisoner. But the colonel blasts him. It turns out he wasn't a man, but a robot. And they head to the ship, and the colonel laments that they can't communicate with Garak Axos. He's just an evil, faraway force bound on conquering this galaxy. We don't even know why. One of the robots grabs Ian, and they all manage to escape in the saucer. And as they do, the timer explosions planted by the enemy blow up the asteroid, our trio getting away just in the nick of time. The colonel talks about the Garak Axos ploy of waiting for the planets to line up correctly in the geography of space, so it shortens the distance that he has to travel for attack. He tells the astronauts that they, the two of them, need to return to Earth to train others on how to make similar spatial calculations so they can predict and then defend. But only the president can be told your full, true story. Only he knows your real mission. Back on Earth, President John Wellman greets the returning space adventurers as the crowd cheers wildly. Later, after the parades and banquets and speeches, Ian and Johnny fill in the Commander-in-Chief on the latest space updates. Jupiter and Mars are carrying the load. They need help from Earth, a big force. And they need more technicians, probably more cyborgs. And then from a side door, an alien, a spaceman, enters the Oval Office, and they all discuss Ian's and Johnny's futures. Both will be returning to space soon. But Ian may not be alone. In announcing this news to his wife, she says, "I'm going into training to be one of the women in space." Johnny tells his mom that he can't visit her for long, because he has to return to spaceport to continue his studies. His mom, remember, a widow of another astronaut, Johnny's dad, encourages him, "Of course, dear, get on with your space business." But after he leaves, she buries her face in her hands, sobbing. The duo blasts off again. And the future looms excitingly for Ian and Johnny. With so much ahead to be done, they are awed into silence. The end.
Trekker Talk, a fan podcast devoted to the adventures of 23rd century bounty hunter Mercy St. Clair from the pages of Trekker Comics by creator, writer, and artist Ron Randall. I'm Darren.
And I'm Ruth. We'll be discussing the stories, characters, and art in this excellent retro sci-fi adventure series, as well as having side conversations about other areas of fandom.
We hope you'll join us as we travel from the dangerous backstreets of New Gallif to the depths of outer space and everywhere in between.
Trekker Talk is available at podbean.com and on iTunes and Stitcher.
Find us at trekkertalk.com.
And we're back. When I was young, one of my favorite pastimes, hobbies, something I dip in and out of even to this day, and I'm currently back in it, is puzzles. Both jigsaw puzzles and word puzzles, crosswords, word search, that sort of thing. My mom always had a few puzzle magazines around the house that she was working her way through. And then when I got into them, I wanted a few of my own. And trust me, if you even started to work on one of the puzzles that my dad liked, let's just say that was not a great move. So having my own puzzle books was a winning solution on many levels. And what I learned was that the best, by far the absolute gold standard, of puzzle magazines were the ones published by Dell. I became a very loyal customer of their magazines, and when someone gave me an off-brand version, maybe a teacher who saw that I liked them, or a well-meaning relative who heard the same thing, I could tell that they just weren't as good. Dell had not only the highest quantity of great types of different puzzles, I always liked the variety books, ones that had crosswords and word search, but also crypto quizzes, high score, logic problem, crisscross, word wheel, just tons and tons, but they were qualitatively better as well. Now, this is before the introduction, to these shores at least, of Sudoku, but there was another cool kind of number puzzle that I really liked called cross sums. Now, I did check recently, and I apologize to Nathaniel Wayne, this does sort of count as research, but last time I was at a Kroger grocery store, which had a decent magazine area, I did see a few dozen different puzzle mags, and Dell was still there plugging away, but they seemed to be being squeezed out of the top spot by a lower-cost publisher, Penny Press. Now, given the nature of this podcast, you would think I would love that. But this might seem hypocritical. I'm not going to rant over this, but I'm sure that the quality of their puzzles still pale in comparison to those put out by Dell. Sometimes, let's just keep this a secret, but sometimes you have to pay for quality. I say all of this to say that for me, Dell is not a comic book publisher. That's not how I have related to them for most of my life. And it's also to say that my experience with Dell and their product line is really, really positive. To me, based on my experience with these puzzle mags that Dell put out, their brand implies quality. And the reason that Dell is not a comics publisher in my mind was that by the time I was paying attention to things like comic book publishers, Dell was out of that business. Despite being a dominant, and for a few years, the dominant force in comic book publishing, Dell began publishing comic books in either 1929 or 1938. You'd think that would be pretty easy to pin down, but it depends on how you define comic books. They eventually ended up publishing a lot of licensed books over the years, including runs of Tarzan and Lone Ranger, and a lot of other Western heroes. And at various points in time, they held licenses for Disney material and characters as well. Now this title, Four Color Comics, was the most notable and prolific in their line. It was published several times a month, and this title primarily consisted of standalone issues featuring various licensed properties. It ran over 1,300 issues, over only a 23-year history. It often served as a tryout title, much like DC's Showcase, and was thus the launching pad for many long-running series, and that's what happened with this title. Spaceman, it ran 7 more issues, numbers 2 through 8, from 1962 to 1964. That's why this is both Four Color Comics 1253 and Spaceman number 1. Now, when Dell was getting to the end of its life as a comic book publisher, the first two Spaceman stories, which would be this issue and Spaceman number 2, they were reprinted as Spaceman 9 and 10. About 8 years later in July and August of 1972. And by 1973, they were done publishing comic books. Now, that line of puzzle magazines that I mentioned before, that still exists as an independent company. And they also publish science fiction, mystery, and other magazines. But the book side of the old Dell publishing, that does not exist, at least not as a separate entity. It's now part of the mega publishing corporation Penguin Random House, having been part of Random House, which had previously bought Bantam, which had previously bought Doubleday, which bought Dell in 1976. But enough about corporate acquisitions. Which is a sentence I hardly ever say in class, by the way. And on to the comic itself, which sadly is also a sentence I hardly ever say in class. Now, listening to that synopsis, you may have noticed that a ton happens in this issue. And there is a very good reason for that. The inside of this comic, between the covers, was 32 full pages of comic book goodness. Four-color comic book goodness, you might say. As a matter of fact, the only ad in the comic was the back cover selling a variety of Daisy guns and related merchandise. 75 years of quality leisure time products. The inside front and back covers were not ads, but they were facts about space travel and the moon, and a glossary of about a dozen space-related vocabulary terms. Actually, these are issue-related vocabulary terms, because not only do they include general words such as G, you know, for a measure of gravity, cyborgs, UFO, and freefall, that glossary also includes Galactic Guard, Viewer, Space Academy. That one's defined as the West Point, or Annapolis, for outer space cadets. It grew out of, but now has absorbed, the Air Force Academy. Or in other words,
Space Force.
They also define Anti-Force, which is the shakiest part of the story in terms of science, but they pulled that off by making the Anti-Force not a real thing, but a part of the story that was being told. So that was a nice touch. The back cover had a series of what they called moon maybes. I like that because we were still pretty unsure what was going on up there back in the late 50s and early 60s. So there are three pretty solid fact-based science panels about moon stuff, and then a fourth panel that goes like this. But suppose a moon man did not feel temperature and did not eat food, but absorbed cosmic rays out of the void of space and communicated with his fellows by sending radio impulses to antennae, where we have ears. And he thought with a brain and had feelings just as we do. Would the moon man be a man? If not, what would he be? Now I know, it seems like I'm avoiding talking about the story, but that is really not it at all. It's just that there were so many cool and weird and enjoyable things about this comic beyond the story that made me smile. And also, I did mostly like this comic. Now, I was inclined to like it, both the science fiction aspect and the Dell publishing aspect. There was a nostalgia for me. And even with higher expectations and looking forward to getting a chance to dig into this, I think it held up pretty well. I've been reading a ton of sci-fi stories from this general era recently through the Best Of collections edited by Martin Greenberg and Isaac Asimov. In the last year or so, I've read three of these, reprinting the best SF short stories from 1957, 58, and 59, along with reading some other pulp sci-fi from the 30s and 40s. And thinking about all of that stuff, what was popular in sci-fi around this time, I think this comic book fits right in. I appreciated the first contact element, the aliens reaching out to us just as we were getting a space program ready. And these guys are basically the Green Lantern Corps, right? I mean, without the magic wish-granting jewelry. But it's a police or military force that protects our area of space. And as soon as we are ready to join in the space race, we are invited to participate. And it's done in secret, so we even get like a spy type of vibe going on as well. That's a great setup for a story to my mind. And I really like the notion that even though all these astronauts either get repelled by this anti-force, and there are a few that just never return to Earth, that despite those setbacks, in this version, we still keep trying. That is a golden age of sci-fi attitude. That we, I mean that as humanity, but also, let's be honest, we're talking about Cold War Americans as well, that we're not going to let a little thing, like being constantly unable to bust through this force, to stop us from trying. There's something so period accurate about that, something so right stuff about that, that just really stands out to me. This capturing of the space attitude, the zeitgeist, good stuff there. And even though we do get a full story in this issue, a trip to space, a battle, and a return to Earth, we end on the promise, or at least the possibility, of new stories. Like we said before, they'll use this as a tryout book or a backdoor pilot, call it whatever you want. And they handled that aspect of this issue well. It doesn't end on a cliffhanger. They wrapped up this particular episode, but this story left us with plenty of opportunity for more stories. Lots of threads still out there, mostly in terms of the alien enemy. What we got in this issue was just a skirmish, not the whole of the war by any means. So that is out there, as well as smaller personal bits, like Ian's wife going into training. So there are plenty of plots and subplots to go to in the following issues. Now, I did check the free archive at digitalcomicmuseum.com, but a lot of four color is not there, as they are not in the public domain, or there's uncertainty if they're in the public domain with so many Dell books being licensed. That confuses the issue a bit. And then, as I mentioned, they've been bought out by at least four different publishing houses over the last 40 years. There were also, by the way, no issues of Spaceman on there either. Because I'll be honest, I kind of wanted to read the next one and see what happened. But most of the items on that site are from the 40s and 50s. So this title from the early 60s, expecting it to be there, even just hoping it would be there, is, I admit, a bit of a stretch. Now, reading a comic from this era, I get a little nervous about the art and coloring. But for what it's worth, both of those areas were better than the average Gold Key or Whitman book that I've read from the 60s or early 70s. Now, the lettering was clearly dated, and I can't really place my finger on why I feel that way. It's just that the font looked old. But that's the only thing that bumped me at all in terms of the, what we might call the production aspects of the book. Like I said before, the cover was solid, a nice bit of sci-fi art. And the paper, it was still holding together pretty well after 60 years. After almost 60 years, and that's worth commenting on. There were certainly some clumsy moments, clumsy sentences in particular, especially those ones that I read towards the end of the story. Ian's wife Mary says, "I'm going into training to be one of the women in space." That just sounds like a strange way to phrase that. Although it is topped by Johnny's mom's comment, "You get on with your space business." What? Who would say that in that way? I have a theory, and that is that the speech bubbles for those bits of dialogue were too small for the script, or conversely, that the script was too long and too big for the speech bubbles, whichever came first or second. I'm thinking maybe there was a miscommunication there, and those bits of the script had to be rewritten, edited, cut to fit into that space, and so they end up sounding that they're worded in a kind of a weird fashion. But those are just minor quibbles at most, which will barely affect the verdict. The verdict on Four Color Comics 1253, aka Spaceman number 1, the story had small issues, a few oddball moments, a weird bit of dialogue here, old-timey looking lettering there. But the story was dramatic, and I'm a sucker for sci-fi comics. So you will certainly have to settle in terms of the condition of the issue. You need to accept a cover with a bite out of it, some water damage, some crumpled pages. Because that's the only way I imagine you'll ever find an issue of this in a cheap bin. But I did. I found one in that condition. So you maybe can too. And if you do, you should pick it up. Because this is a total quarter bin steal. And that wraps up our coverage of Four Color Comics 1253, a.k.a. Spaceman number 1, bringing Quarter Bin Podcast episode 144 to a close. And next episode, we'll be starting a two-episode miniseries covering a total of four issues. This is our latest sojourn into a dead universe. A few months back, I put out a Twitter poll with three or four choices for which dead universe I should cover next. And the clear winner in a landslide, both in the popular vote and the Electoral College, the clear choice was Jack Kirby's Universe from Topps Comics. So next time in episode 145, we'll be starting that by looking at Secret City Saga 0 and Bombast number 1 from, like I said, Topps Comics. Both of those cover dated April 1993. If you have any questions or comments about this issue or the episode, sci-fi comics, word puzzles, or the podcast in general, feel free to contact me. Until next episode, I'm Professor Allen, and I'll see you in the quarter bin.
The Quarterbin Podcast is part of the Relatively Geeky family of podcasts. Show notes and links are available at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com, where the podcasts Uncovering the Bronze Age and Shortbox Showcase also make their home. Links to Facebook and Twitter are there as well. Feedback for the show is welcome at relativelygeeky@gmail.com. And if you like what we've got going here, please leave a review and a rating in iTunes. It'll help more people discover the show. Thanks again for listening.